You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of November 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're live from Studio One in London with me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with Geoffrey Kaufman, ABC's London correspondent. Geoffrey, what do you have for us this morning?
A dangerous piece of brinksmanship between China and Japan, and has Boris Johnson gone too far?
Looking forward to that. More from Geoffrey later. Also on the programme, it's turning into a showdown between Russia and the EU. We'll be in Brussels to find out why Moldova and Georgia are being asked to choose sides.
Plus, get on your wellies because we're about to go truffle hunting. Thing is, you might want to try and grab a specially trained pig that can help you sniff them out.
So we're just opening up a plastic bag of truffles here, and this is maybe half a kilo?
Oh yes, it's more than a kilo actually.
So yep. This is more than 1,000 euros worth of truffle. Oh, and the smell is unbelievable.
And get ready to hop into bed with Hong Kong's most promising young designers. Fashion writer Daniel Kong will be discussing the upcoming event In Bed With Designers.
All that plus we'll be leafing through this morning's Italian front pages, and we'll also play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a packed show up ahead, but first of all, at a minute past eight here in London, let's catch up on the news headlines from around the world with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The United Nations says it now believes more than 3 million people have fled the civil war in Syria. Officials have registered more than 2.2 million refugees, but say many more have disappeared as the fighting continues. As all sides prepare for UN-backed peace talks in January, the High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, says the huge numbers escaping the violence must not be forgotten.
This is the moment for the international community to fully understand that the support provided to the countries of the region needs to be strongly enhanced. Needs to be really massive, because there is a risk for the asylum space if that doesn't happen.
A summit of EU leaders continues today in Lithuania. The centrepiece was meant to be the signing of a trade pact with Ukraine, but the country scrapped the plan last week. President Viktor Yanukovych came under intense pressure from Russia not to sign, but he's at the summit despite that decision. Yevgenia Tymoshenko, daughter of Yulia Tymoshenko, the jailed former Ukrainian prime minister, says the summit will prove to be an embarrassment for the country.
Ukraine, with the hands of Yanukovych, will fail the summit, will fail the signature, and the consequences it might have back in Ukraine are unpredictable. And really, people who are whose promises he broke and who are disappointed with his reversal now may flood the streets.
The European Union's top humanitarian official has warned that peacekeeping forces currently deployed in the Central African Republic need to be significantly boosted to stop the worsening sectarian conflict and provide security for aid workers. Fears are growing over the living conditions of tens of thousands of people displaced because of sectarian violence. The nation of 4.6 million people has descended into chaos since the Seleka coalition of rebels, many from neighbouring Chad and Sudan, ousted President Francois Bozize in March. The UN estimates that 400,000 people have been displaced and 68,000 have fled to neighbouring countries because of the violence. Kristalina Georgieva is the EU's Commissioner for International Cooperation, Human Rights and Development.
Unless there is an immediate significant change in security conditions, these two risks, they can deepen so much that we have a tragedy in our hands, and then we look back and we say, why didn't we act sooner? Clearly what needs to be done is to beef up significantly peacekeeping forces, significantly, triple or quadruple what is there.
The head of a supermarket chain in Latvia has been sacked over comments he'd made after one of its stores collapsed in the capital Riga last Thursday, killing at least 54 people. Prime Minister Valdis Dombrovskis resigned after the disaster. When asked whether any company executive should follow his example, Gintaras Jasinskas, chairman of Maxima Latvia, said it's those who feel guilty who resign. The group's chief executive has announced that shareholders have decided to dismiss Mr. Jasinskas. Two men alleged to be members of an illegal betting syndicate based in Singapore have been charged with conspiracy to defraud as part of a match-fixing investigation into lower league football in England. One is a 33-year-old Singapore national, the other a 43-year-old with dual UK and Singapore nationality. They're among six people arrested earlier in the week on suspicion of match-fixing. The seventh man has since been arrested. He and four others were bailed on Thursday. The arrests are said to include three current footballers and one former Premier League player. An internet news source is reporting that three unpublished stories from the reclusive US author J.D. Salinger have been leaked online, with the source apparently an unauthorized book that sold on eBay. BuzzFeed said it was difficult to trace the origin of the collection called Three Stories, with the only known copies existing in research libraries at the University of Texas and Princeton University. The book appears to be one of those in a 25-copy compilation of the stories privately printed without Salinger's permission in London in 1999. One of the stories is a prequel to Catcher in the Rye, featuring the younger brother of its main character, Holden Caulfield. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. It is 6 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And welcome back. It's time now to set the day's news agenda. And joining us in the studio is our favorite friend, I think, Jeffrey Kaufman,
ABC's
London correspondent. Welcome to the show, Jeffrey.
It makes you feel better for getting up in the morning. I tell you, yes, happy day after Thanksgiving to all our American listeners.
You were mentioning at the top there, brinksmanship in Asia.
Brinksmanship. Yeah, this is an interesting little story. You know, we've been so focused on what's been going on in Iran and in Syria in the last couple of weeks. And yet there's this simmering little dispute happening over what really, when you think about it, is just a pile of rocks, the Senkaku Islands. There are five islands and three rocky outcroppings off the coast of Taiwan. Japan has controlled them for over a century. No one lives on them. And apart from the birds and the fish around, no one really has reason to care about them, except that China does. And China has declared its air zone expanded to include this region, and in fact, a much vaster region beyond. Japan not happy, America not happy, and tensions rising to a serious level.
So what's happened? Japan and South Korea have now flown planes over that newly declared
and the
air
U.S.
defense zone.
As well. And the U.S. flew some B-52s this week through.
Just to make the point?
Well, you know, there is a tide of nationalism rising in China. There is a similar tide in Japan. And you know, these are crazy little disputes that happen in the world. But you have to watch them, because when pride and nationalism mix, it can become quite toxic. And you know, China surely can't really want to provoke a confrontation with Japan and the U.S. and Korea, all of whom have an interest in this area. This is an assertion of Chinese sovereignty, they're saying. Of course, there is oil at stake. There are fishing rights at stake. But it really seems to be more about the politics of xenophobia, of China's leadership saying, you know, we are not a passive player in this region, enough American dominance with Japan.
And of course, it's not going to help that the U.S. and Japan also putting on their own show of force in the region, the kickstarting of the annual X war games between Japan and America, some of the largest war games on the planet.
Off Guam, yeah.
I'm just wondering, something's got to give here. Who is going to be the losers and who's going to be the winner?
You know, it's looking like China's backing down already. they had said any commercial flight flying through this vast area has to notify them in advance. Now they're backing off a bit. They didn't do anything when the Japanese, Korean, and American jets flew through. They seemed to understand that an act of serious provocation could start something that no one wants to see. And you know, you have this massive growth in the Chinese military in the last 10 years, just staggering, and an Air Force that has grown exponentially with very young and inexperienced pilots. And you know, there is, you have to watch very carefully, because there is the possibility for mistakes in this area.
Let's move over to a story about an individual who is no stranger to acts of massive provocation himself, London Mayor Boris Johnson. He's been accused by his critics of unpleasant elitism after the comments that he made yesterday, essentially saying that some people are too stupid to get on in life.
I'm really surprised by this. Boris Johnson is speaking at a Margaret Thatcher lecture, sort of channeled Margaret Thatcher, and I think almost moved further to the right than she ever was.
Well, we've got a clip of that. Let's have a listen.
The income gap between the top cornflakes and the bottom cornflakes is getting wider than ever. I don't believe that economic equality is possible. Some measure of inequality is a valuable spur to economic activity.
So he's talking about cornflakes. He also says that we should be focusing on the portion of our population with an IQ above 130. That's the 2%, and really, there's not much we can do for the 16% with an IQ below 85. And boy, I mean, talk about elitist remarks from the boy from Eton. It seems to be so against Boris.
Is it, though? Boris plays politics like no other, as we know, and he wants to be leader of the Conservative Party. There's a massive challenge. He's got to move to the right if he's going to get anywhere close to that leadership. They've got threats from UKIP. They've got threats from the right. You know, this looks like very cynical posturing.
But if he indeed becomes leader of the Conservative Party, these comments are not going to do very much to help him in the general election.
Exactly. I think you're absolutely right. He is positioning himself to succeed David Cameron. There is no question that's what's going on here. I just question whether the long-term judgment, as Phil notes, is going to help him win a general election. These are incredibly incendiary comments and to a lot of people, deeply offensive. Nick Clegg, the deputy prime minister, has already jumped on him and as you've noted, called him an elitist, a careless elitist, and others too. And there's a strange, deafening silence from the Conservative Party about what he said.
Yeah, I gather
I think people quite shocked.
Number 10 said that the Prime Minister believes in social mobility. That was about all they could come up with. I mean, what's really staggering is this is the Mayor of London, a very mixed society. As you say, this looks incredibly insensitive to the millions of people living in London who are doing low-paid jobs, who are working incredibly hard as home carers or cleaners or whatever. You know, it looks unbelievably insensitive to the people who are supposed to be his people.
He even went further and channeled Gordon Gekko of Wall Street, the film fame, and said, you know, greed is good. And you know, there is a real impatience, not just here in London, but in all of the financial capitals of the world about greed and how it has taken over the financial world in the last two decades. You're right. He is pandering to the conservative rump of the Conservative Party, the far-right rump. But this is not a way to win a broad consensus. You know, the thing about Johnson that's always fascinated me living here is that here's a man with, you know, financially conservative principles, but has been seen to be socially progressive, inclusive. You know, this is an incredibly well-run city, and you know, coming from Toronto, with where we have a mayor. Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, I'm sure Rob Ford, the mayor of Toronto, if he knew where London was, would be saying, "Oh, thank God, they're talking about another mayor today." But you know, this is such a well-run city, and I think, you know, everyone would agree that Boris deserves a lot of credit for it, for the staggering improvements to transit and infrastructure here.
And indeed, he supported the minimum wage for Londoners, the London minimum wage,
a living wage. In fact, that's right. And so the question is, did he have to go this far? You know, there's a funny term in American television sitcoms called jump the shark. Its origin goes back to the old sitcom Happy Days, but it means that the plot has gone one step too far and it's lost credibility. People have lost faith and the TV show is on its downward arc. And I have to say, I wonder whether Johnson may have jumped the shark with these kind of incendiary comments.
And finally, Jeffrey, one last topic. It is the day after Thanksgiving, and I know you're a bit depressed because you're here in London and you're not hitting the stores in the U.S. for Black Friday shopping.
I think it's a huge relief. You know, I just think you get seduced into thinking that you got to be there. And anyway, who needs to go shopping in the world of cyber shopping? You can just do it online.
I was going to say, I gather that Amazon are doing a Black Friday bonanza as well.
And they're even doing one here in the U.K. It's interesting, you know, it's already talk about cultural hegemony. Canada and Australia have already adopted the Black Friday notion, and their retailers here are pushing it as well. It's not clear it will succeed, but you know, this is said to be the biggest shopping day of the year, the time when stores move clearly from the red into the black, which is the origin of the term, and it will give us a real sense of just how robust the economies are, and particularly the American economy.
Do we have a sense of how big, like what kind of numbers people are expecting today?
Not
in terms of both
tip.
Values and people showing up?
You have to call in your retail analyst for that one.
But it's going to be worth bazillions.
Absolutely.
That's
excellent
the technical
stuff.
Term.
Happy Thanksgiving.
And if you need any help, I'm a size small just for Christmas. if you have any ideas. Jeffrey Kaufman, ABC's London correspondent. Thanks very much.
That small, really.
Still to come, we go truffle hunting in the south of France. No Black Friday deals there, sadly. But first, we're in Vilnius for the European Union's Eastern Partnership Summit. That's right after this.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Phil Hahn. The time is 10:17 in Vilnius, 9:17 in Brussels and 8:17 here in London. Now, the meeting at the European Union's Eastern Partnership Summit in Lithuania was originally meant to be an event that would help welcome in former Soviet blocs into the EU, whether through closer economic or political ties or both.
But instead, the meeting has been overshadowed by the Ukraine's halting a cooperation agreement with the EU last week over claims that the jailing of former Prime Minister Julia Tymoshenko was being treated with selective justice. So what can we really expect from this summit, and what does it mean for other nations like Moldova and Georgia who want in? Well, we're on the line with our Brussels correspondent who has been following the talks, Charlotte MacDonald Gibson. Thanks very much for joining us here on the program, Charlotte. This summit, it's really just been dominated by the Ukrainian news, hasn't it?
It has up until now. I mean, the EU has spent all year really promoting this summit and talking about how it's going to be expanding its reach further east. But Russia really has to pay to that by putting so much pressure on some of these six countries that were meant to be attending this summit. And yeah, absolutely. When the Ukraine last week turned around and said, actually, no, we're not going to sign this agreement, it really put a spanner in the works for the whole summit.
Charlotte, I gather there was a dinner last night in Vilnius that was attended by the Ukrainian president and EU leaders, including David Cameron, François Hollande, Angela Merkel and co. That must have been rather awkward, was it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was some rather optimistic hopes that there could be some last-ditch deal reached at this dinner, but indeed they did prove to be too optimistic. All the statements out afterwards and this morning have made it quite clear that there's absolutely no chance at all that the Ukraine's going to change its mind. So yeah, probably would have been a little bit frosty over the canapes, but the EU are now moving on. They're really trying to look today at the other positive aspects of it, and that's the two countries, Moldova and Georgia, which are actually initialing the agreements today.
Absolutely, Charlotte. You mentioned those two countries there, Moldova and Georgia, but both countries wanting very different things.
Well, yes, both countries have very different histories and requirements, wants, needs from the EU. Basically, these association agreements are pretty wide-ranging treaties which deal with all sorts of things like trade and economic integration and security ties. They're seen as like a sort of baby step on the path to eventual EU membership. So if we look first of all at Moldova, that's a tiny country, very, very poor indeed. It's got a per capita GDP of around $3,500, which puts it in the same levels as Laos and Ghana. So for Moldova, it's really about economic integration. It's about having a new market for their goods. Russia's already closed off their market to Moldovan wines. The EU has turned around just early this year and said, okay, well, we're opening up our markets to Moldovan wines.
But if
so
we shift,
you're already seeing that.
Sorry, Charlotte, if we shift from the kind of economic element to the political, I mean, one of the rationales of EU expansion surely is to spread democracy and human rights. And many commentators will be saying there's still entrenched corruption in places like Moldova. And surely that needs to be rectified before they get any closer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the key rationales, the key driving factors of the EU is to spread the tentacles of human rights and democracy as far as they can go. So certainly the EU actually sees these agreements as achieving that in a way, because a lot of the aid that's specified in these agreements is tied to democratic reform, and that is really being stressed at the summit as well. So they're hoping that these deals will indeed bring that democratic reform. And you're absolutely right, a country like Moldova, it really languishes very low in Transparency International's corruption index. So all those problems, I mean, EU membership is a very long way off because there are really serious problems in countries like Moldova.
Well, a bit of a power struggle there between the West and Russia. Russia seeming at least to be losing quite a bit of its influence. Is there anything that the Russians can do to reclaim some of that back?
Well, I think the Russians have really scored the major victory in this whole Eastern Partnership process by getting Ukraine to pull out at the last minute. I mean, if you look at the size of these countries, I mean, Moldova and Georgia, they've got populations of around 4 million people, whereas the Ukraine's 46 million. So Ukraine was really meant to be the highlight of this summit, and that Russia has managed to put the economic pressure on them and convince them not to sign it. I think overall it's definitely chalk one up for Russia this time.
It'll be fascinating to see how this one unfolds. We'll have to leave it there. But Charlotte McDonald-Gibson, our Brussels correspondent, thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Well, it is 22 minutes past the hour here in London now. Tuber melisporum, better known as the black truffle, is one of the world's greatest delicacies. But if you thought hunting for these truffles was an easy thing, you might want to think again. Well, they can indeed be very, very expensive. And potentially, they could be a lot more if it weren't for the help of very skillful pigs. Yes, I said that right. It's pigs. These creatures have a remarkable ability to sniff out truffles growing deep underground.
Well, Monocle's Michael Booth has snuffled down perhaps the world's most important truffle company, Plantin, in the south of France, where, as truffle season begins in earnest, he finds out more about the mysterious, murky world of this smelly subterranean treat. That's for this week's edition of The Menu.
I can smell them from here. The smell is absolutely mind-blowing, really overpowering. It's like mushrooms and cheese and nuts and just filling the air, toasted smell. Bonjour.
Truffle season is just beginning. It lasts from mid-November to early March, and I've just walked through the door of the world's biggest truffle dealer, Plantin of Puymaure in the Vaucluse, northern Provence. Their warehouse and offices are located in an anonymous light industrial estate building on the outskirts of this tiny Provençal village, with only a discreet sign, yet they trade in over 16 tons of summer, autumn and winter truffles a year, with a turnover of 10 million euros. Inside, I meet with Plantin's French sales director, Florence Plaision, to hear more about the company and its extraordinary produce. First, I ask how she would describe the taste of truffles.
It's quite light, nutty. It has a little bit of noisette inside. It's quite subtle as a taste. But what is very important is with fresh truffles, the best is to use it just as it is, not to really cook it. Because if it's cooked, I mean, it loses its taste.
Your truffles, do you source them just from Provence or further afield in France?
It's more from Provence. We have two markets where we go. It's Richerange and Carpentras. It's next to our company. And we have some farmers from the area who comes here in the company to bring us their truffles.
Now, the truffle buying and selling is famously very secretive, and there's lots of kind of dodgy deals go on and people fake truffles and those kind of things. So when the truffle season starts, you get everyone from all around, just local farmers coming with a bucket and a bag and their trousers tied up with bits of string in here. Is that right? That's how it happens?
Yes, of course.
So out of your 16 tons a year, how much of that comes from people just bringing them coming here, or how much is you going out to markets and buying?
The most important part is, of course, from the markets.
And where do you sell your truffles?
So we sell it all over the world. In Europe, we sell in Germany, in Austria, in Switzerland. We work as well in England with Dubai.
And is that directly to restaurants or to wholesalers?
Well, in France, it's directly to restaurants. And a little bit as well with wholesalers. And in Europe and in the rest of the world, it's through wholesalers.
And you sell to some quite famous French chefs, is that right?
Yes, that's right. We work with Robuchon, Guy Savoy, as well with Ducasse.
Florence told me that in recent years, truffles have been selling for around 1,000 to 1,200 euros per kilo. I wondered what affected truffle prices and, most importantly, would this be a good year for truffles?
So it depends completely on the season. If we have a lot of truffles, and if they are nice, of course, and good quality, the price is going down. But these few years, it was nearly the same and being a little bit up each time. But we hope that this year will be a good year.
Why is that? Because of good weather, obviously. But what exactly do truffles like in the weather?
So what is important for us to have a really good season is to have some rain at the good period. So normally it's good to have a storm or heavy rain around the 15th of August and sometimes during the summer. For the moment, it's very good because we have some sun, we have some heavy rain, so we hope it's going to be good. And we must not have some frozen time, otherwise if it touches the truffle, it's not really good.
So we come out into the little boutique you have here at Plantin, and members of the public can just come here and buy fresh truffles if they want during season, right?
Yes, of course. We are open from Monday to Friday, and we can sell a little bit of our product. So we have a range of preserved truffles, and we have as well the olive oils with truffle aroma or sunflower oil, and we have as well a range of condiments, so salt with truffle, mustard, tomato, a salsa as well, which is a mixed with truffles and mushrooms, and which is great to toast.
I have to ask you about truffle oil. What is truffle oil? It actually has nothing to do with truffles, does it?
No, we don't put a truffle inside because it would be too expensive. We add a natural aroma, nearly natural, and it gives the taste of truffle in the oil.
I took a lot. So we're just opening a plastic bag of truffles here, and this is maybe half a kilo?
Oh, yes, it's more than a kilo, actually.
Oh, more than a kilo? So yep. This is more than 1,000 euros worth of truffle. Oh, and the smell is unbelievable, in a good way, but almost in a bad way.
If you want, we can even weight one, just to...
Yeah, let's see how much it is. They're surprisingly firm, with a surface almost like a pine cone, very black, and inside light brown with white veining, and... Oh, man. The smell is fantastic.
So just to give you an idea, this one is nearly 100 grams.
So that's 100 euro.
Yes.
100 euro, and it's about the size of a small clementine. How do you best like to eat truffles, Florence?
Well, I think the best is fresh, not cooked, on a toast with olive oil and salt. Just that it. The best then with eggs is to put the truffles in the fridge with the eggs, just like this, and just during the night.
In a sealed container or something?
Yes, exactly, in a sealed container. And then the day after, you prepare your omelette and...
And the eggs truffles. Will taste of omelette, of truffle?
Yes, exactly. The eggs will have taken the perfume, the aroma and the fragrance of the truffle.
Do you ever get sick of eating truffle?
No, never.
For Monocle in Puymorat, France, I'm Michael Booth.
Well, he certainly sounded like he was having fun, didn't he, Michael Booth? That was from this week's edition of The Menu, which also features luxury kebabs in Paris and a Berlin beer that's been given a new lease of life. And you can catch that programme tonight at 1900 hours London time.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the program, we'll be in Athens for a check-in with our correspondent there, and we'll also be discussing the emerging trends in Asian design with fashion writer Daniel Kong. But first, here is Barney Burnham with the latest world headlines.
Thanks, Phil. The United Nations says it now believes more than 3 million people have fled the civil war in Syria. Officials have registered more than 2.2 million refugees, but say many more have disappeared as the fighting continues. A summit of EU leaders continues today in Lithuania. The centrepiece was meant to be the signing of a trade pact with Ukraine, but the country scrapped the plan last week after coming under intense pressure from Russia not to sign. The European Union's top humanitarian official has warned that peacekeeping forces currently deployed in the Central African Republic need to be significantly boosted to stop the worsening sectarian conflict and provide security for aid workers. The head of a supermarket chain in Latvia has been sacked over comments he made after one of its stores collapsed in the capital Riga last week, killing at least 54 people. When asked whether any company executive should follow the Prime Minister's example and resign, the chairman of the company said it is those who feel guilty who resign. Two men alleged to be members of an illegal betting syndicate based in Singapore have been charged with conspiracy to defraud as part of a match-fixing investigation into lower league football in England. And an internet news source is reporting that three unpublished stories from the reclusive US author J.D. Salinger have been leaked online, with the source apparently an unauthorized book that sold on eBay. One of the stories is a prequel to Catcher in the Rye, featuring the younger brother of its main character, Holden Caulfield. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back at the top of the hour with another check of your world headlines. It is 10:32 in Athens, 8:32 in the morning here in London. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Clemency Burton-Hill.
And it's time now to check in with our woman in Athens, Natalie Savarikas. Nice to have you on the show, Natalie. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Not great news for the Greek economy, though. That's going to shrink for the seventh successive year, says the OECD. Tell us more.
Yes, absolutely. And it's actually contradicting what Athens has been saying. They were hoping for glimmers of growth for next year. The OECD, however, says that Greece very much will continue its recessionary trend and is also warning that Greece might be in the grips of deflation that could be quite menacing for countries who are just trying to recover from a borrowing binge, because when prices essentially drop, the real value of debt increases, which in turn makes it very, very difficult for already struggling families or businesses to service their loans. But of course, on the other hand, Greece is hoping that it will have cheaper prices, which is essentially what deflation is, because it hopes to attract investors and boost its competitiveness. So a lot of contradictions there for the Greek country and for Greece especially, as authorities are really trying and struggling to recover from this massive bailout and, of course, this whole recession.
Absolutely, Natalie. I think our listeners would be quite confused as to who to really believe here, because just last month we heard from the Greek government, as you mentioned there a little bit ago, that they would finally be in budget surplus. We saw glimmers of hope. The Athens stock market was seeming to be recovering. Who should we believe here then? Is it the OECD that's right, or is it the Greek government that's right?
Well, I can tell you, as far as the Greeks, the ordinary Greeks on the ground have been experiencing it, they're not seeing any glimmers of hope. The unemployment figures are expected to come out today, and unemployment in Greece is at 27%, the highest in Europe. So if we're trying to convince anything or anyone, and if the Greeks are going to believe anyone, I think they're going to be looking towards the OECD and not towards the government, whom, of course, they have a vested interest in convincing not only the Greeks, but also markets and investors that the news is going to be on the positive side in the years to come.
Let's move on to an extraordinary story that's being attributed to a typo and an editing error. This was this WHO, World Health Organization report that came out a couple of months ago, which stated quite explicitly that HIV rates and heroin use in Greece have risen significantly, with about half of new HIV infections being self-inflicted to enable people to receive benefits of 700 euros per month and faster admission to drug substitution programs. That was the statement that the World Health Organization made 2 months ago. Now they've been forced to retract that claim and have unreservedly apologized for, as I say, what they said was an editing error. This is just extraordinary.
Yeah, it's actually like sent shockwaves around Greece. I mean, many on the internet were quick to say that, you know, just this hatred towards Greece. There's been like a vilification, if you like, but it all, as you mentioned, came across as a very badly worded statement that was published in September. Instead, what the World Health Organization was trying to say is essentially that slightly more than half of Greece's new HIV cases are among users who actually used needles to inject drugs. That's what they were trying to say, but it came completely wrong. And the source of this report was from the medical journal The Lancet and the Greek Documentation and Monitoring Center for Drugs, which essentially in their report, in the 2011 report, referred to only accounts of deliberate self-infliction by a few individuals. So completely magnified there by the World Health Organization. And I can tell you that the Greeks were furious at that. But of course, what is happening in Greece, and that is without a doubt, is that we've seen a dramatic surge of HIV cases in the last 2 years, some 57% increase from 2010 to 2011, and a 1,450% increase among drug users. And that is the real numbers. That is the truth. But of course, the whole case that they're self-inflicted cases just to have access to a 700 euro monthly benefit is just an aberration.
Some startling figures there, absolutely, Natalie. Let's move on to your final story, which you've got for us, and it's about same-sex marriages and partnerships.
Yes, I mean, it's really interesting. Greece is a very conservative country. It hasn't, if you like, legalized same-sex partnerships. It had tried to introduce a law in 2008, agreeing to, like, paving the way to civil partnerships. But, of course, it had outlawed same-sex couples from registering. And now the European Court of Human Rights condemned Greece for that and called on the country to introduce legislation ASAP that would allow same-sex couples to file for civil partnership. But a senior Orthodox cleric, because the Orthodox Church in Greece is pretty important, Metropolitan Seraphim of Piraeus lambasted the government plan and actually warned any MPs who would vote for this new legislation that the church would excommunicate them. So let's see how the authorities here will maneuver, if you like, in order to introduce this legislation in a very conservative society.
Natalie, he didn't just talk about his communication. His language was incredibly strong in his condemnation of alleged efforts to make what he calls this terrible sin of homosexuality, sodomy, unnatural sexual intercourse, pederasty and paedophilia appear as normal behaviour, as mere diversity. That is very strong language. How has that gone down amongst any community in Greece?
Well, I think they were all, not all, because as I said, there are like many in Greece are very conservative. Of course, the gay community here is really trying to establish itself, although it's keeping a very discreet, if you like, lifestyle. But it's prompted fury, especially in the center-left and lefty community here, which increasingly Greece is trying to rid itself of its conservative past and its ties with the church, and trying to explain, especially to the older generations, that, you know, the male and female archetype couple is something of the past, and it's time that Greece catches up with its time and introduces same-sex partnerships. Now, of course, as you mentioned, yeah, very strong and controversial word usage from the Metropolitan Seraphim, saying even that it's an unnatural aberration and not even observed in animals, he was quoted as saying. So Greece, again, trying to, you know, catch up as a most Mediterranean and Eastern European countries with same-sex partnerships. The community is really trying to catch up with modernity, if I may say.
Natalie, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House. Natalie Tsavarikas, our woman in Athens.
You're listening to Midori House. I hope you have your PJs ready at hand, because after this very short break, we're going to be heading to the In Bed with Designers event in Hong Kong.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time, it was seen with disdain, but over the years, that culture had gotten so popular, it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu. Every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 16:41 in Hong Kong. It is 10:41 in Istanbul and 8:41 in the morning here in London.
And how do you fancy a weekend in bed with designers? Well, that's what's on offer in Hong Kong this weekend, courtesy of e-commerce website Buy Me Design. 50 international emerging designers will take over three floors of the mini hotel, turning them into pop-up boutique showrooms open to the general public, from Korean stationers to Lithuanian fashion accessories. In addition, the event will see a key roundtable discussion focusing on the question, what is curation in Asia?
Now, one of the guest speakers at the event is fashion writer Daniel Kong, who joins us now from our bureau in Hong Kong. Daniel, welcome to the show. Just give us a little brief on exactly how exciting this In Bed with Designers event really is.
Hi, Phil. Thank you so much for having me. Definitely, everyone in the town is very excited at the moment, not only with In Bed with Designers, but because of Business of Design Week, Hong Kong in Design, and Detour Hong Kong. There's a lot of initiatives happening right now. So we're having from all of the world coming. We're very excited about all the new exciting ideas and products that are coming out.
Tell us about some of the highlights that's going to be on show this weekend.
Oh, definitely. So with In Bed with Designers, some of the key products that are available that you'll see in some of the shops, there's a label called La Tour Eiffel, and they're going to be selling adult sex toys at the moment with the tag of the Frenchiest sex toy in the world. We also have Korean accessories and stationery, and as well as a Lithuanian fashion designer called Este Nesterovaite, who's going to be selling a few of her scarves, as well as a series of envelope-shaped bags.
Now, I think for some people, when you think of these kind of design events, you think of a gorgeous exhibition hall. Perhaps there's a stunning venue that the event is taking place. How different is this? I guess it's because it really just almost sounds like, you know, a bunch of designers who just rented out a bunch of hotel rooms and decide to throw a little festival for them and their friends. Do you think this type of event will gain traction and help younger designers really take shape?
You know, I think it's really great. Yeah, I think it's a really great idea because right now in Hong Kong, rent is rising dramatically. And because of that, a lot of emerging designers don't have the financial resources. They don't have the ability. They don't have investors who are able to help promote their brand, especially with brick and mortar stores. And so, you know, although e-commerce is helping them, promoting something through a hotel, especially somewhere as stylish, as nice as the Mini Hotel, I think it's a really great initiative, and I hope to see it in the coming years as well.
Daniel, the key topic up for discussion around the roundtable and the opening evening is what is curation in Asia? I know you're speaking at this event alongside other magazine editors, architects, luxury entrepreneurs, designers. It's clearly a hot topic on everyone's lips. So give us your take. What is curation in Asia?
I think curation in Asia, I think that really is about two points. The first is the idea of what is curation. And curation is really about having a point of view, being able to take different elements, you know, it's a bag or a shoe, and putting it together in such a way that the ecosystem of all of these products, these colors and textures and lines, is much greater than the sum of its individual parts. And so when you bring in the component of Asia into it, when you think of Asia, especially in Hong Kong, when it's very crowded and you have a lot of big major labels here, a lot of different brands, and it's very crowded. So you really need to stand out. And especially in Asia, you need to have a razor sharp voice when curating, you know, whether a series of paintings or a series of products that you're going to be showing in your retail store.
And you say, you know, this event is a very much an Asian event, but of course there are designers from overseas, quite a few from Sweden, Lithuania, as we mentioned. Do you think it was right that they kind of incorporated other countries' designers into this event, or would it have been a stronger event if it focused merely on Asian designers, up-and-coming Asian designers?
I think it was good that they incorporated people from Europe, from the Middle East, from Asia, because in a way you're putting everyone on the same platform. Because by the end of the day, promoting Asian design is really great, but by the end of the day, people have to like the product. So if you can compare something that you see in France with something that you see in Lithuania, comparing something hand on hand between Serbia and Korea, that's the best way to go about promoting design in Asia.
And Daniel, I'm sure there'll be a couple of glasses of champagne, maybe some cocktails. Are you a bit worried that something could happen in some of those hotel rooms?
Maybe, especially with the sex toys available there. We'll have to see.
Excellent stuff. Well, I hope you have a good time. Daniel Kong, fashion writer, thanks very much for joining us on the program.
Stand back from your letterboxes and tone up your biceps, because the biggest ever issue of Monocle is about to hit subscribers' doormats and newsstand shelves. The December-January issue helps you bid farewell to 2013 and look over the horizon to 2014 with our soft power survey, the Monocle 100, and our travel top 50.
In the culture section this month, we look at how Art Basel Miami has sparked a resurgence in the art scene in Colombia, Brazil, and Argentina. We put on our board shorts and head down to San Clemente in California, where an old school magazine for the surf community is refusing to water down its offering for the digital age.
In the design section, we look to the future, meeting the heirs to the throne of design family businesses in Denmark, Bali, and Brazil. The CEOs of Artek and Todd's tell us about the year ahead. And then we visit the home of a South African national architectural icon as Cape Town celebrates its position as World Design Capital in 2014.
In the edit section, we take you on a shopping spree in Lisbon, visiting inspirational stores for Christmas gift giving. Plus, we publish our annual Travel Top 50, a roundup of the best planes, trains, hotels, restaurants, services, and special discoveries that have made our trips over the past 12 months more enjoyable.
The Monocle December-January double issue is on newsstands now.
It's 8:48 here in London. In just a moment, we'll be leafing through the Italian front pages. But first, we have a little time to play you a song. David Pleasant, who'll be here shortly, chose a song that isn't Italian exactly, but it embodies a dolce far niente lifestyle. This is Weekend at Rome by Etienne Dao. That was Weekend at Rome by Etienne Daou.
And you are indeed listening to Midori House here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Clemency Burden.
Sadly, we're not in Rome.
A weekend trip in Rome would be quite
shall
nice.
We, Phil, shall we, Phil? Should
it?
We just do it?
I'm up for it. What about you, David? David Pleasant joins us now in the studio with a stack of Italian newspapers. Would you come to Rome with us?
Yeah, why not?
Little
Let's
three-way
go.
Holiday.
There's
Let's
nothing go. Going on politically in Rome, though, so it's probably kind of boring right now.
You're very boring. Absolutely nothing. It's probably one of the biggest weeks in Italian politics for a long time, as we've all heard all week.
Don't say his name. No more.
Mr. B.
Just go away.
Yeah. Mr. B. So the papers are obviously filled with the kind of fallout of him being removed from taking office, banned from taking office for at least 6 years. La Stampa, Turin's daily, has done quite a funny piece, basically saying that, it's just kind of analysing what must have gone through Berlusconi's head. He said he survived the first night. He's obviously now, he's not impeachable. He's without protection of the law, as it were. So he survived the first night, and apparently his doctor made a statement. The doctor's called Professor Zangrillo, said that he didn't even take any sedatives, and he woke up feeling like a lion. So he's obviously not giving up the fight. And this article actually
goes... He would have been quite curious, though, if he had taken loads of sedatives and had still woken up feeling like a lion. So that's
exactly.
A little bit curious. Berlusconi the lion. I'd love to see that.
Exactly. But it kind of seriously, this article suggests that one option for Berlusconi might be to take up a candidature abroad and actually become a European parliamentarian.
Can't you just see those countries rolling up, lining up to have him?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this comes after a similarly impeached Italian politician, Giulietto Chiesa, went to Lithuania, where he became a candidate there and re-entered politics through the back door of Brussels.
Well, there is another option as well, David. The 28-year-old girlfriend of Silvio Berlusconi, Francesca Pasquale, has asked for an audience with the Pope to help clear his name. Do you think that's potentially an option?
That could be one as well. I mean, you never know with Berlusconi.
This Pope does seem like he's capable of producing miracles, but that might be a bridge too far.
Yeah, and there is quite a lot about the Pope as well in the papers. He seems to be on yet another mission to help the poor, but I thought we would go...
Silvio Berlusconi, maybe not his target audience then.
Exactly. And talking of the rich and the poor, there's another story from La Repubblica that is centering on students at Rome's various universities claiming hardship allowance and grants, when in fact they have more than enough money to pay their way. This article highlights that the Guardia di Finanza, which is the financial police of Italy, has been really doing a raid against irregularities, and they've come across so far in 2013 340 cases of fraud. One case, a girl, a student, claimed that her family's income was combined at 19,000 euros, when in fact they had an inheritance. They just received an inheritance of 600,000 euros.
It's absolutely remarkable, isn't it? When you consider just how many people under the age of 26 are unemployed, finding it difficult to get by in Italy. What's been the reaction in the Italian press, I assume?
Well,
it's vicious.
It is still quite a local story. It's just in the Rome section of the La Repubblica. But I mean, we're seeing a lot of these, a really strong reaction against these kinds of fraud, these kind of misdemeanor that probably would have gone under the carpet in previous years. But there's a big reaction against it. And in fact, the police, the Guardia di Finanza, it said has made a statement that they will use all of their powers to make sure that not only are the students that any kind of grants, even if they may be entitled to some, any kind of grant is cut from them, but they'll be facing criminal proceedings.
That should be a deterrent then for anyone who's thinking of fiddling the system.
Exactly, exactly.
And just very quickly, David, so reaction from the president of Italy.
That's right.
Forza Italia.
Yeah, kind of more seriously and more, kind of more tricky situation now faces the president. Really, this is kind of centres on what to do with Berlusconi's party, Forza Italia, which is now the main opposition party within Italy. The main problem is that they enabled the government to take power. It was a coalition back then, and now they've kind of been decapitated, but they're still there and still present. So Napolitano did invite members of Forza Italia to the presidential palace yesterday to try and thrash out a solution. Many of Forza Italia's representatives have actually resigned. So it's a very kind of uncertain future for the party now.
Well, unfortunately, the future of this Midori house is almost nigh in that that is all we have time for. But David Pleasant, as ever, it's lovely to have you with us.
See you in Rome.
See you in Rome, exactly, bye-bye, for that hot weekend. thank you very much indeed to our producer, Daphne Denis, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Nabia Iqbal, and our studio manager, Bill Luti. Up next, after the Monocle 24 News, is Section D. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York. Emma Nelson and Victoria Graham will be back with Midori House at the same time on Monday. But for now, from me, Clemency Burton-Hill.
And from me, Phil Hahn. Thanks very much for listening and have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.